Lowliness. The 10th talk in a series on the fruit of the Spirit was presented by Ron Julian on September 10, 2000, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Good morning. We're back looking at the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians. For those of you that have been following along with this, you know that that means that we're not looking at Galatians at all. Paul has given a list of what he calls the fruit of the Spirit, and what we've been trying to do is go to other places, to other passages in the Bible, to get some sort of feel for what these qualities are. What does he mean by them? The one that we're talking about today seems to me especially important to do that. We have come to the fruit of the Spirit that the New American Standard translates as gentleness. This is the word that you sometimes see translated as meek or meekness. Okay, so we're talking about gentleness here. This is one of those words, however it gets translated, meek, gentle, whatever, that we really don't have a very good English word, I don't think, to capture exactly what this is getting at. And it always seems to get misunderstood. I mean, the idea that the meek shall inherit the earth is something that we have has carried down to us in our culture. It's one of the things that Jesus said that everybody is familiar with. But I think very few of us actually know what does that mean. There at the radio station on Sunday night, they have cartoons that people have put up on the walls in various spots. And there is this cartoon that is a newscaster saying that, yes, it seems that it really is has finally happened. The meek have inherited the earth. And you see all of these people, you know, sort of geeky kind of folks with glasses with tape around them, you know, and that kind of stuff, listening to Lawrence Welk records and that sort of thing. That's the only image we could come up with. What exactly do we mean by the meek? So today especially, you're just going to have to bear with me. We're going to try to go on a search here to see if we can get some sort of feel for what is this quality that is a fruit of the Spirit. What is it that the Spirit does in us? What is it that we are being exhorted to follow here? Some of my thinking about this started when I was studying the Beatitudes, because Jesus does use this word. He says, blessed are the, this word, for they shall inherit the earth. And it was in that study that I first tried to sort of put this together. And my attention was drawn to a couple of passages in the Old Testament. Partly because Jesus himself, when he says, blessed are the meek or the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth, he is quoting a psalm. That line is not original with him. That line first appears in a psalm in the Old Testament. And so it was appropriate to go back and to try to figure out, well, what was it saying there? So I have that passage and another one in the Old Testament I want to take you to. Let me remind you, I'm not going to go into all the ins and outs of it here, but there's a certain complexity in this process. There is a Greek word being used that is used in the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. So the word that we're talking about here in the original text in the Hebrew was a Hebrew word. When Jewish scholars came to translate that Hebrew word later on, they used this word that we're concerned with today to translate it. So there are wheels within wheels here, but I'll try to make it not too complicated. The place I want to go first is in the book of Numbers, chapter 12, starting in verse 3. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well?" And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth. And suddenly the Lord said to Moses and Aaron and to Miriam, "You three come out to the tent of meeting." So the three of them came out. Then the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the doorway of the tent. And he called Aaron and Miriam. When they had both come forward, he said, "Hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, shall make myself known to him in a vision. I shall speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, even openly and not in dark sayings, and he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses?" Okay, so you picture the situation here. Moses is unique among all of the prophets of Israel. If you remember the story, Moses actually encountered a form of God. God took a visual form in front of him and spoke to him on several occasions. Moses regularly used to go into the tent of meeting, which was an early version of the temple, essentially go into the Holy of Holies before the glory of God and speak with him. And then he would come out and report to people what it is that God had said. You may remember that in the story, the glory of God would shine on Moses' face. He had been in the presence of God's glory, and when he came out, that glory was on his face, and people were afraid of him. I mean, there was something very scary about somebody who had been directly talking to God. Well, Moses was called by God to be the leader of the people. Miriam and Aaron, who were Moses' brother and sister, were also leaders of the people. Aaron was going to become the foundation of the priesthood. Miriam was a prophetess. So they start saying, "Look, you know, our brother, Moses, he's a prophet, but so are we. We give messages from God. People are supposed to listen to us. Why is everybody making such a big deal about Moses?" And in essence, they were jealous. They were ambitious. I mean, they looked at the situation and said, "Moses has this respect among us that we feel is inappropriate. We deserve a piece of that." God's response to them was to make it very clear that Moses had a unique role. He said, "Okay, you guys are prophets. You've spoken for me. You've given a word for me. That's great. I mean, you know, I knew it. I know who you are. But Moses is unique. What makes you think that you could set yourself up to be on a par with Moses? Because Moses has a job to do that is not your job. He is the leader. He is unique among all the prophets, whoever will be until that day when the last prophet comes, because I have chosen him to talk to him directly. He doesn't just get a vision in which he's given a message and he has to go write it down. I'm talking to him and he talks back. We have a conversation about this stuff. This is unique. I don't have conversations with you about this stuff. I have conversations with Moses." So, and you may remember the story, ultimately Miriam, who seems to have instigated the thing, has a form of leprosy that comes upon her for 7 days as this sign of God's displeasure. Okay, why am I telling this story? It's because of this little aside in the middle of it. Now, the man Moses was very humble, more than any man who is on the face of the work, on the face of the earth. And this is the word that we're concerned with here. They've translated it humble. I like the translation for this word something like lowly, because it kind of captures, not perfectly, but it more captures the idea. Gentle, I think, can be very misleading. We have gentleness and gentle. It sort of implies somebody who is soft and squishy, someone who wouldn't dare raise his voice, you know, that sort of thing. And that can be misleading, I think, as to the quality that's being talked about here. The quality is lowly. What it is about Moses is unique among the prophets. He has this personal relationship with God, unlike a relationship with God that any other person has had. And yet he does not push himself forward. Why is he in that position? Because he was ambitious for it? Because he wanted that role and he sort of lobbied with God to get that? No. In fact, when God offered him the position, you may recall he turned it down. He said, I'm not qualified. You don't want me. Now you should Aaron would be a good choice. He's very eloquent and boy, people would really listen to him. Moses was not in a high and exalted and important position because he sought it. He was there because God put him there, even though he did not seek it. That's what the text is getting at here, I think. This little aside that was stuck in. By the way, it's interesting to think about the fact that I believe that, in general, it is true that Moses is the author of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. So it's interesting to ask the question, who put in the comment, now the man Moses was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth? My understanding of what's happening in the Old Testament is that when we call Moses the author of the Pentateuch, he is the source of the things that we find there, but there are things that are inserted at various places, I think, that are not by Moses' hand. And I just have this hunch that that's probably one of them. But you get the idea here. It is having that attitude that I am not going to push myself forward. That's the quality that Moses had. Okay, now the other place I want to look is Psalm 37, which is the psalm that Jesus quotes in the Beatitudes. And it's a long psalm, but I'm just going to start at the beginning and take a few verses, and then we won't go through the whole thing. Psalm 37. Do not fret because of evildoers. Be not envious toward wrongdoers, for they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. Okay, so the theme here is there are evildoers in the world. Don't fret over them. Don't be envious of them. The fact is that in the world in which we live, those who will abandon principle can often make their way in the world and accomplish things that seem to be enviable. By taking things into your own hands, you can get things that other people will look at and say, you know, that looks pretty good. I could worry about them, or I could be envious of them, because they seem to have gotten something that I haven't. But what the psalm says is, don't worry about that, because in the end, and this is a psalm that is very much dedicated to exploring the difference between where are we now and how is it going to end up. Where we are now is, yes, evildoers seem to be prospering, but that is not the way the story is going to end. And this is very much a psalm about wait for the end of the story. For they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. It's not going to last. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in him and he will do it. And he will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your judgment as the noonday. So, here now, we have what is being put in opposition. Don't worry about those who seem to be prospering because of their evil doing. Instead, trust in the Lord. Trust in the Lord. And the emphasis here is on how this is going to turn out. This is not look, I can tell you how today you can end up with just as much stuff as all of those evildoers around you. He's saying, no, there is an outcome to all of this. Trust in the Lord and He will bring it to pass. There is a time coming when He is going to change the way things are. And those who have trusted in Him are going to be raised up, and those who have opposed Him are going to be brought low. You know, we could say in a sense that that is one of the primary themes in the Bible. That theme runs through the Old Testament and the New Testament. I find it everywhere. That idea that there is this ironic sort of inversion that is going to happen one day. Those who seem to have everything now are going to lose it. And those who seem to have little except God now are going to be raised high. And in the end, it's who is prospering when the story ends up, not when it starts, that is significant. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for Him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who carries out wicked schemes. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret, it leads only to evil doing. For evildoers will be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord, they will inherit the land. So, rest in the Lord. There are, I don't know if you can see the theme that's emerging here, but there are those who are ambitious. They're reaching out, they're grabbing, they're looking for what they can get, and in the process, they are resorting to evil. They're restless and aggressive, ambitious, and they're doing what is wrong in order that they may gain. And, I mean, there's all kinds of ways that that can happen. I don't think I have to remind you all of the ways in this world that people can get what they want by abandoning principle. What we're being urged to do instead, what the people of God are being urged to do, is rest in the Lord. To have a certain confidence and trust. This rest is sitting back and saying, I am not going to grab, I am not going to go out there and battle with everyone else for what I can get out of this world. I am confident that by putting my trust in God, that what I need as a human being is going to come my way. Ultimately, I am looking to the promise of the kingdom of God. When he says here, those who wait for the Lord will inherit the land, that picture of inheriting the land is alluding to the promises that were made to Abraham. This is written to the Jews now, we have to understand, at the time. God had made promises to Abraham and to his descendants that he would bless Abraham, he would bless his descendants, and they would be given a land in which they would prosper as people. Well, when David is writing, they're in that land. But there's all sorts of trouble in the world. Wicked and evil people are prospering. And it doesn't seem as if this land that they've inherited is really such a resting place after all. I mean, is this it? Is this the rest that we're looking for from God? I think David is alluding ultimately to the fact that God still has a fulfillment of that promise to make. To bring his people into rest. Jesus then echoes this language when he says that the meek will inherit the earth or inherit the land. It could, in essence, be the same thing. But now he's not just talking about a physical descendant of Abraham living in Judea for the course of his life. He's talking about in the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, he's talking about the kingdom of God. Entering into the land eternally, having a place to live, a place to dwell that is ours, a place of blessing, a place where life can truly be lived. It is the meek who will inherit the land, who will find in the end their home in God's kingdom. That's what Jesus is getting at. But he's drawing that idea from this psalm, I think. It's implicit in what David is saying. So, the irony here is the evildoers will be cut off. The one who seems to be prospering now, he's carrying out wicked schemes and prospering, it's not going to last. In the end, he will be cut off. But the one who waits for the Lord, that's the one who is going to inherit the land. The guy who's scheming right now may seem that he's grabbing up the land around you, right and left. He's not going to keep it. It will not be his. It is not his inheritance, it is your inheritance, if you trust in God. Yet a little while, and the wicked man will be no more, and you will look carefully for his place, and he will not be there. But the humble will inherit the land, and will delight themselves in abundant prosperity. Here's that word again. The humble, the meek, the gentle. I think the lowly captures the idea of it the best. It is those who are not high because they have been ambitious and put themselves there, but they have taken the lower path. They are waiting on God. I have not presumptuously thrust myself forward to say, I am going to grab and make sure that I get what life needs to give me. It is those who have recognized that everything comes from God, who have put their trust in Him, and thus are resting, they're waiting for God. So, this word, the lowly, there is certain lowliness to it in the world's eyes. I mean, the wicked, those who are prospering in this situation, are oftentimes looked at with respect by the rest of the world because they have, you know, got what it takes to succeed. But is the ones who have not put themselves forward that in the end God is going to exalt. I think this is exactly the picture that Jesus had in mind when he told that strange little parable. He was at a banquet and he saw people sort of jockeying for position. You know, there are the more important tables at the banquet. And he saw some of the Pharisees kind of, you know, working to get themselves up at some of the higher tables. And the parable he told was, you know, I don't think that's the way to do it. The way I think you do it is different. Because if you go and you put yourself at the high table, you know what's likely to happen? The host is going to come in and he's going to consult his list and say, oh no, excuse me, you're not supposed to be at that table, you're supposed to be back here. And in front of everybody, you'll be embarrassed. Instead, what you do is when you arrive there, you go and you sit in the back. Then when the host comes in, he looks and says, oh no, you're not supposed to be back there. Here, come on up. So instead of being embarrassed and humiliated, you will be honored. And he uses that just as a picture, I think, of the way the two kinds of attitudes we can take toward life and toward God. We can grab for it, in which case God comes along and says, no, sorry, that's not for you. Or we can sit in the back, trusting that the host really does want us at this banquet, and he will bring us forward at the proper time. And the classic statement is, he who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. So, in this statement, it is the lowly, the humble, the meek, who will inherit the land. Not the aggressive, not the ambitious, but those who are waiting on God. Jesus himself is an interesting model of this quality. The word is used in when quoting... it's gone out of my head. Is it Isaiah? I've forgotten. In Matthew 21, when Jesus is about to enter into Jerusalem, he comes riding in on a donkey. And the quotation from, I've forgotten. I think it's Isaiah, but I've forgotten. Say to the daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming to you, gentle and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a beast of burden. Well, again, you can see gentle is probably not the best way to translate it. That's the way New American Standard did it there, but that's not. He is coming to you lowly and mounted on a donkey. He is not coming on a war horse. He is coming on a beast of burden. He is coming not in a blaze of glory, but lowly on a donkey. I think this is a very interesting example because Jesus is a model, in a sense, of meekness, of humility. But what is he doing in this situation? He is riding into Jerusalem as the king, as the Messiah. He's not coming in lowly in the sense that the people call out and he says, no, 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 be quiet, I'm just another guy. You know, don't make a big deal out of me. The people cry out and the Pharisees are outraged and they say to Jesus, tell your disciples to shut up. Listen to what they're crying. Listen to what they're saying about you. And Jesus says, it wouldn't do any good for me to tell them to shut up because if they shut up, the very stones would cry out. That's how confident he is that he is the king of the world and that they are rightly acclaiming him as the king of the world. And yet, he is coming in as king, lowly, humble. He doesn't deny that he is king, but he's not making a big deal of himself, if you know what I mean. His messiahship means everything. I think we see this even more clearly in another passage from Matthew. In Matthew 11, Jesus talks about becoming his disciple, and he says in 11:29, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle, it's this word again, and humble in heart, and you shall find rest for your souls. This take my yoke upon you is the language of discipleship. Jesus is really making a bold statement here. I mean, he is saying, I am asking you to make me your teacher, your master, your Lord. That's what the image of the yoke is. I mean, it's like the farmer who has put the yoke on the oxen. I mean, it is a limitation. He does that to keep them together, to make it so that they can do work for him. I mean, they are his servants. The imagery of a yoke isn't the imagery of submission. I'm going to put my neck in the yoke. Take my yoke upon you, he's saying. He is acknowledging, I am asking you to submit to me. And it is right for you to submit to me. I am your teacher. I am your master. I am the king of the world. And you should take my yoke upon you. But why should you take it upon you and learn from me? Why would I be a good person to learn from? Because I am lowly and humble in heart. Well, this has puzzled me for a long time. Because this statement of Jesus being lowly and humble, meek. If you read the Gospels, there's a sense in which he is anything but meek. He never backs down on anything. Every person he talks to, there is hardly an encounter that he has with a human being that we see in the Gospels where he is not in some way getting in their face. I mean, even his disciples say nice things to him and he gets in their face. I mean, he's correcting people all the time. He corrects the Pharisees, he corrects the crowds, he corrects his disciples, the closest people to him. Get thee behind me, Satan, he says to Peter. I mean, this is not a Casper milk toast kind of guy. He is, in some senses, very aggressive. He is aggressive for the truth. He casts the money changers out of the temple. He's got a whip. And yet Jesus describes himself as being lowly and humble in heart. And this is what I understand him to mean right now. I think the claim is true. I think he is lowly and humble in heart. But we have to understand what it is that we're talking about here. He's not lowly in the sense that he is reluctant to call me to obey him. He's not lowly in that sense in the slightest. But he is lowly, I think, what the idea is here, is that he is lowly in the sense that the authority and the power that he has, he does not exercise for his own benefit. How many people in our world have the ability to have some sort of position of power without having it go to their heads and actually start using it in a way that makes it possible for them to get what they want? I mean, we just see it all the time. Power means the ability to get what I want. And we confuse the notion of authority and power very easily. Jesus can say, I want you to take my yoke upon you because I am lowly and humble in heart. I'm not going to take advantage of you. You take my yoke upon you. I am not going to take the fact that you are my student, you are my servant, and use it against you for myself. I'm not doing this for me. I am not pushing myself forward. I'm telling you simply, truthfully, I am the teacher. I am the master. And if you come to me, you will find life. Take my yoke upon you. I'm not doing this for my sake. I'm doing it for your sake. And if you take my yoke upon you, you will find rest for your souls. My yoke will not become a burden that will make you a slave who will find a burdensome, wearying task that ends up benefiting me and draining you. No, you take my yoke upon you, and I'm going to be working for you. I'm doing this for you. I think that's what he means by his lowliness, that he is not personally ambitious. He himself waited for the goodwill of the Father, the good pleasure of the Father, to raise him up. He did not exalt himself. Yes, he was king, but he would wait until God made him king. James, in chapter 3, is talking to a group of people where I think what has happened is there are leaders among the churches, and those leaders he describes with the qualities of jealousy and selfish ambition. There is a battle for control. There is a battle for power. Everybody trying to push themselves forward to gain the upper hand, and so on. And this is the chapter in which James says to them, you know, I don't think very many of you should be teachers. Because look at you. I mean, look at what's coming out of your mouths. Look at the ambition, the selfish ambition that is driving you. In 13, he says, who among you is wise in understanding? That is, who are those who should be in a position of having some sort of leadership among you? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. And the idea here, it's the humility, the lowliness. There are all of these ones who are battling for power and trying to make their own little empire in the world. The very fact that you're trying to do that marks you as somebody that shouldn't be leading anybody. The ones who have wisdom are the ones who demonstrate that wisdom in a certain kind of lowliness, a certain kind of willingness to take a back seat. They're not seeking their own at the expense of the people that they're teaching, but are trusting in God, who have confidence in God, and so they can wait on the Lord, just as they're asking you to wait on the Lord. That idea that this lowliness, then, is not just an attitude that we have towards God, but it is an attitude that works itself out in the way that we deal with each other. It worked itself out in the way that Jesus deals with us, but it also works itself out then in the way that we deal with each other. And that's the essence of the quality as Paul is talking about it in Galatians. How is it that we demonstrate this lowliness that he's talking about? It's in the way we interact with each other. And just to make that really clear, at the end of the section where he talks about the fruit of the Spirit, towards the end of Galatians 5, listen to what he says. If we live by the Spirit, let us also walk by the Spirit. Let us not become boastful, challenging one another, envying one another. Brethren, even if a man is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. It's the same word that he used up above in the fruits of the Spirit. Lowliness, humility. What has been happening among them? As we've said over and over again from week to week, Paul is arguing against legalists, and in their legalism, it has come to a place of contention. You guys aren't doing it right. I'm doing it right. That's how I know that God likes me. You're not doing it right. That's how I know that God doesn't like you. It leads to a kind of spiritual envy, a kind of contentiousness. Who's the one who's doing it right? And so on. Paul's saying, you guys, the very attitudes that you're adopting in your so-called commitment to the truth show how far from the work of the Spirit this thing is that's happening among you. Let us line up with the Spirit. What is it that the Spirit is calling us to? He's calling us to be humble. He's calling us not to demonstrate how superior we are because we're doing it right and everybody else isn't, but rather, even if a man is caught in a trespass, and it's that word even is very significant there. It's even. I'm not just talking now about you have some differences of opinion about whether you're supposed to eat kosher or those sorts of things. Even if you catch a man caught in just flat out sin, I mean, he's committing adultery or whatever it might be. There's no question about it. This is sin. This is evil. What kind of attitude are you going to take toward him? Restore such a one in a spirit of lowliness, each one looking to yourself, lest you too be tempted. The temptation to use other people's problems as a lever to elevate ourselves is a great one. But what we're being called to is lowliness. To see ourselves as we are. Sinners needing and getting the mercy of God. So Paul's concern here, the quality that he's talking about, is a kind of resting in God, trusting in God, taking the lower place, not grabbing and fighting for the honor and the riches and whatever it is this world might offer, because I recognize who it is that I am trusting. And because of that, then, the way I deal with you is going to be lowly, humble. That's what I'm being called to do. I'm being called to see my position before God, to rejoice in my position before God, and not make of myself more than I am. And it seems to me that as we look around, the world around us, people that we know, would charge many Christians with being anything but lowly and humble. And I think that there is a certain amount of justification in that. I think that it's not hard, actually, to look around in the Christian culture as we find it, and find people who are using their Christianity in essence as a platform for raw ambition. We all like power. We all like to be up front. We all like to be respected. We all like to have control. We all like to make money. And there are people in the world who, in the name of Christianity, are seeking power, prestige, money, control. And it's recognizable. The world around us recognizes it, and we recognize it. It's not hard to see. That's a terrible thing. It's very far from the quality of lowliness, humility, that Paul is saying is a fruit of the Spirit. I think it's important, though, that we be careful as we think about this, because I would argue that Jesus, in a sense, was the lowliest, the humblest of men. And yet, he's king. He commands. He's not asking me my opinion. He has a message. He's not going to change it just because I'm unhappy with it. In one sense, then, he is a rock. He is unchangeable. He is unmoving. He is powerful. He is authoritative. We, as followers of Jesus, I think, are going to, if we are genuinely following him and genuinely becoming people in whom the Spirit is at work, that same sort of ambiguity is going to be there as well. On the one hand, we will be learning to be lowly, to be humble, to not make of ourselves more than we are, to be trusting in God, looking to him to ultimately redeem our lives, and willing to sacrifice ourselves as Jesus was. It's that great moment in the upper room where he washes the feet of the disciples. And then he says, "Do you know what I have done? Do you understand what I have done? You've called me teacher and Lord, and you're right. I am. So I'm the teacher, and I'm the Lord, and I washed the dirt off your feet. So what should you do for each other? Are we going to lord it over each other, or are we going to take the attitude, the place of the servant?" So on the one hand, hopefully, we are learning to be lowly people. And yet, at the same time, we are followers of a great king. And we believe that we have at least some grasp of the truth. And the truth is not negotiable. And so I think the world around us, we ourselves at times will be confused about what sort of people are we. In a sense, we want to be the lowliest of people. And yet, in another sense, we want to be prepared to cast out the money changers. We want to be prepared to stand up for the truth. Happens to be going, I go along. That's not what we're talking about. Hopefully, if I'm committed to the truth and I have understood what that truth is, that commitment will be deep. I'm standing on a rock and I'm not willing to get off and stand in the sand. And yet, standing on the rock, I know who I am. I know my need of mercy. I know that even my master took the low road, and so I'm called to do so as well. Lowliness, it seems to me, is an intrinsic implication of our faith. That's why it's one of the fruits of the Spirit. The Spirit of God is helping us to understand what it is we believe and what it means to us personally. And one of the things it means is, I do not have to ambitiously put myself forward. I do not have to seek honor because God is going to exalt me. I do not have to seek security beyond what is appropriate because God is going to take care of me. I can take the low road because I know the God that I'm following. Okay, well, I'd like us to take a few minutes if you have any questions or comments. I hope I've been clear about this word. This is one of those elusive terms that's very easy to mistake what it is talking about, I think. Look.
It sounds like submission. It's a being willing to accept what you get from God.
Yes, I think so. You sometimes find this word, gentleness, in Paul's writing in conjunction with another Greek word, hesukia, which is quietness, but it doesn't mean not talking. It means, as I understand it, just it's like submission. It's like, I am not talking back. I am not complaining. Look what you have done to me. I trust God, and I accept what He has done for me. And those two qualities, that lowliness and quietness, are often kind of joined together. My acceptance of it is undergirded by the fact that God has promised to do well by me. I am not just accepting it because what else can I do? He's God. He's awful. He's terrible. I wish He weren't God, but I'll accept it because I can't win. It's not that. It's He has promised to do well. You know, wait on the Lord and you will inherit the land, kind of that sort of thing. So, and then that submission, that acceptance of where I am now, makes it possible for me to deal in humility with others. I'm not in competition with you anymore.
Would it be fair to use a sports analogy, I guess? And
you will have to do it.
Okay.
I know nothing about sports. Go right ahead.
I don't know much about it either, but I'm thinking of this prototypical sports figure. In one sport, he's like the best guy in whatever sport, and he's also very proud and boisterous and braggadocio and swaggers into the room and all that sort of stuff. And then there's another guy in another sport. He's equally as good, if not better, but he doesn't even look at people. He just quietly enters the room. Everybody knows that he's the best, but he doesn't make a show of it. He's just very quiet and unassuming.
Yes, and in fact, you have to forgive me because I'm about to extend your sports analogy, and I am so ignorant about these things. But here's my entire education in sports. For the last decade, I have spent almost every Sunday night with Tony Arlen and Jack Crabtree doing that radio show. And often afterwards, we sit around and talk. And if you're going to be in a conversation with Tony Arlen and Jack Crabtree, fairly quickly, the topic is going to turn to sports. Because Tony has a passion for basketball, and Jack has a passion for soccer. And so they talk about it all the time. So I have picked up a few things along the way. And one of the things that comes up in their conversation that strikes me in this context is if we talk about the unselfish player, the player who may be very skilled and is very desirous for the team to win, but is not competing with the other members of the team for the ball, you know, but is actually, like in basketball, but is working with the others to accomplish the goal of getting the ball. And, I mean, that's as far as I can go with that. But that seems to me to have that sort of, I'm not saying when the ball comes to me and I'm a good player, I'm not passing it back and saying, oh no, you know, I wouldn't know what to do with it. No, I mean, I know I'm a good player. I will take the ball and I will do what's appropriate, but I'm not trying to score off you. And so in that sense, there is a lowliness, a humility. I am taking my place in the team as opposed to pushing myself forward. And if the rest of the team were to decide to keep getting the ball to me because I'm the best at getting it into the basket, well, that would be appropriate. But that's for us all to decide together, not for me to assert that kind of thing. You all know I know nothing about sports, so that may not be anything like what happens in basketball, but it sounds good.
I just wanted to say I appreciate your message today. I believe it was inspired and given to you by the Holy Spirit.
I can add to that. I was just thinking that I believe that's why the teaching here affects my heart so much. I keep getting puzzled with the way God works, and yet it kind of makes me smile. Things like, you know, having His Son be born in a manger, not telling very many people about it. I mean, so that when things start to get so well known and What am I trying to say? Like when Christians really try and market things or celebrate them in such a big way, I really get suspicious because I just don't know very many times that God works that way unless nature does something huge or so. He uses something else to speak. And so sometimes I shake my head about the teaching here. It's like, why isn't it known all over the world? And it's not the way God works. He works in these little quiet, what I would call background ways, and yet huge change can come for the end of the story that I can't even see. So I think in as much as everyone here continues with that state of an appropriate lowliness about really, I think it comes when you revere God's authority and sovereignty, it kind of puts you in your place. And as you appreciate that, in as much as that is happening, I think God will continue to speak and bless. And I'm just really, I know we say this every time we come, but perhaps you need to hear it again. And it's important.
Well, that's good. Obviously, I mean, just speaking for myself, in all sincerity and I don't have to tell you that this is true because you all know it's true. I mean, I'm a person, human being, as a sinner who's quite capable of thinking too highly of myself and wish being ambitious for myself and all that kind of stuff. But I can say about the teachers around here that we're very committed to the truth of this sort of thing. I think you will find us at times not being as lowly as we ought to be, but I value that approach very much. I don't. It really pains me that that we as Christians have such a reputation as being somehow as being in this for personal gain of a certain kind. That we're ambitious people. You know, I told you this before, but this is sort of related. But years ago, I heard this joke that Bob Hope told. He said I was in an airplane, and it was announced that we were going to crash, and the plane was going down. And somebody said, somebody should do something religious. So I got up and took a collection. That's really funny, but I wish it were not so true. I wish it did not ring so true, that somehow we give the impression that the reason we do this is to somehow advance ourselves in this world, and that all of us ought to be committed to something different than that. Well, we're kind of out of time.